Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Literary Viewpoints, and I am waiting for John Land and Heather Graham to take center stage. And while I'm waiting, let me announce that today is my niece Carly's 16th birthday, and happy birthday, Carly. And Carly is very excited because she has been asked to try out for the show Voice. So I really wish her a lot of luck, but she has to remember that school is education and that comes first. Waiting for John Land to check in and Heather Graham. I'm going to give it another 10 minutes and see what happens. But while I'm waiting, I will also tell you that on the oh, here he is. This is great. Thank you. Good morning, John. We're live.
Hello, Fran. How are you?
Okay, waiting for you. What's up?
It's 10 o'clock. I'm right on time. Give me some credit.
Yeah, I know. We're live. That's okay. And is Heather Graham there too?
She will be here soon.
Oh, okay, good. So this is a very interesting book, everybody, The Rising. And it's a co-collaboration between John Land and Heather Graham. And Alex is a football star, and he thinks he's got the world at his feet until he has a terrible accident, and it lands him in the hospital, and then everything turns kind of dark. So Alex's doctor is murdered, and then his parents, and everything, wherever he goes, death follows. So tell us how you came to create this novel, John. How did you decide to collaborate, and how did you go about it?
Well, that's a long question.
I know. I just made it up, too.
Yeah, and I think it starts with the reason why. Well, Heather and I had always wanted to work together. We had always, and then Tor Books, my publisher, started a program with NASA where they were trying to brand. NASA was going to use books to help rebrand themselves to get back into the consciousness of young people. If you ask a fourth grader what NASA is today, the majority of them don't know. They've never heard of it. They can't tell you what it even means. So this was a way for NASA to get back to their roots, to get back to the to build themselves back scientifically from the ground up, to interest people in the future of the space program. So here was this opportunity. We wanted to work together. Tor had this program with NASA. So we said, you know what? Let's try something we've never done before. Let's try let's go out of the box. Let's try something that's edgy. Let's try something that features more young heroes. Let's try sci-fi. Let's go diametrically opposed to what either of us have ever done. And that's how it happened. Now, I forgot, what was the second part of your question?
How did you come to decide to create something like this? You collaborated and want to work together. So who created the science part and who created the plot part? I mean, because it's NASA. You know, this book is when I reread it again, I realized that this would attract a wider audience than just adults and reviewers, that this might attract a wider audience of young teens and young adults too.
Yes. And so what's your question?
My question is, how did you create the character of Alex and the fact that he is not from here? And did you create the science part, or did she, or did you do both?
Well, we worked together on everything. Exactly. It was literally a total team effort. I handled a little more of the technology and stuff like that because I'm sorry, I'm trying to get Heather the phone number. She doesn't have it. So I'm trying to do two things at once here, Fran. I'm having a little bit of a problem.
Text her the
she
number.
She doesn't have the phone number. So I've got to get her the phone number so she can call in. Can I do that and then we'll come back?
You could do that at the same time, yeah.
Okay, I'm doing the best I can here.
That's okay. So everybody, while John is doing that, let me tell you what I have planned for this month. And you never know what Fran's going to have planned. Next Thursday, the author Mary Jones of Child's Play will be here on Thursday the 26th. And on the 30th, I don't know how I did this, I got six authors, and we had a phenomenal panel show about narration, narrative point, and character voice. The next one on the 30th is going to be on voice and point of view. I've got Alan Topol, Bruce Coffin, Linda McDaniels Can't Make It, Christina Hogue, and several other people that are going to be there. David McAuliffe, who is fantastic, and Larry Farmer. That should be really interesting on the 30th. And then on February 2nd, I've got Nightbird, Brian Freeman. That's a scary book. And on the 6th, Concrete Smile, about gangs and gang war in Hawaii. Whoa. The 9th, I have Cardiac. And the 16th, believe it or not, I've got John Land, David Morrell, and Andrew Gross for a panel on mood and tone. So
that
we're still waiting
good.
For Heather.
Yeah,
it sounds
I just
really
the phone
good.
Number. She'll be calling in any second.
And I definitely have the questions. I'll have to send it to you guys. David was more than happy to do it, and Andrew slipped. You know, he said that would be great, but just
three. That's a good panel. But getting back to where we were with this, we wanted to do something different. The opportunity was there. As far as the science goes, science and technology and action, that was more of my strength. So I think I handled a little more of the background, the research. And where, you know, Heather, I think, was vital when it came to the relationships and everything else. That's really the centerpiece of this is the relationship between the hero, Alex, and the heroine, Samantha, who's actually his tutor. Alex is a high school football star. So that's the whole thing about this book. It has young characters, young heroes in what is clearly an adult story.
Good morning, Heather. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Thank you. And I apologize. Apparently technology was not kind last night. It did not put things through for me. So I apologize for being late.
That's okay.
And whatever John told
you,
rest assured. Oh, well, thank you so much. I was going to say, whatever he told you, don't worry. It's a lie.
I know.
That's what writers do for a living.
Absolutely. Actually, that's true. Yeah.
this novel was really caught me by surprise, I have to tell you. As I'm reading about Alex, and I'm going like, oh my God. So he has a football injury. It changes his life. And when he finds out about his parents, how does he react to that? That was scary. That he didn't really realize where he's from. So Heather, did you create that, or did John create that, or did you both?
I don't know. I think we both created it. It's just, you know, it's funny now because, of course, obviously by the time a book comes out, it's been in some time. And I think, honestly, if I were to look at things now, I wouldn't always know if John had done it or if I had done it. I think we just wound up being incredibly lucky in that we do just complement each other and it's really hard to tell who exactly thought of what sometimes because it did just turn out.
And I think what you're alluding to, Fran, I mean, all great science fiction is metaphor. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what this book has been compared to by several people is Robert Heinlein's work, especially Stranger in a Strange Land. And basically what you just did something that no one else has done yet, and I want to give you a compliment on that. You just described Alex's plight. You know, as someone who finds out nothing in their life is what they thought it was, who finds, you know, in the midst of his teenage years that, you know, his life is in crisis, that he's got all this chaos. That's a metaphor for so many young people today at this age who are struggling with where to go to college, with if they get into college, how to pay for college. So what Alex is going through in an exaggerated sense, what's happening in The Rising that he is experiencing – is what all teenagers, 16, 17, 18 years old, Alex and Samantha are both 18 years old in this book, or close to 18. It's what all high school seniors experience, the degree. It's a transition. There are many transitions in life, let's face it. But I think the transition, and Heather's got five kids, so she's going to be much better able to speak on this than I am. But I think the transition between high school and moving on to college and beyond is one of the most dramatic transitions. So everyone who reads this book, and this is the thing that great science fiction, that great storytelling in general, if you look at books like Divergent, like City of Bones, like Hunger Games, like The Maze Runner. And these are series that compare favorably, or are The Rising compares favorably to. They're all about that same theme. They're all about uncovering the fact that what you thought of your life is not the way your life really is. So I actually think that's one of the most effective parts of The Rising. I think emotionally, that's the core of the story.
I think too, in general, we all have a tendency to get caught up in minor details of life. You know, is this going to work? Is that going to work? Am I going to have to take the bus? Or, I mean, just silly things that we get into, or the traffic is terrible, or, you know, I mean, just the little things that annoy us suddenly mean nothing at all, you know, when you're struck with something like what does happen to Alex. And I think to me something important about Alex is that he may be alien, but he's incredibly human.
That's such a great point.
His soul, his heart, everything about him is very human, which of course gets into the rest of the book and get it too, because we have some aliens who want to do nothing but communicate and make life better for everyone, and then we have aliens who want to dominate and seize power and control everything, you know, basically ruthless, and will kill anything in their way. So that's not so different in my mind than what we already have on Earth. We're just dealing with different capabilities, and but particularly in Alex's case, I think he's dealing with the fact that he did have this beautiful life. He had a life where it mattered what college he went to. He was doing brilliantly. He was such a football star. And as far as the academics went, he had Sam, who was brilliant and helping him. So, I mean, everything was good, and then everything was as horrible as it could be. So it's his life just flips on him completely, and he has to deal with it.
And I think that where we're going with the story,
yeah.
And I would add Samantha to that. Samantha, her life was charted as much. I mean, she's going to be a scientist. She's going to work at NASA. She's already interning in the book at the Ames Institute for Astrobiology. So she has got a very regimented, organized life. Everything is, you know, she's living her life based on post-its, you know, kind of like, what am I going to do next? And she knows everything she's going to do next. And her life is totally thrown into upheaval. And I think when you look at classic stories throughout literature, heroes very seldom choose to be heroes. They very seldom wake up in the morning and say, today I'm going to save the world. There are exceptions to people characters who accept that mantle. And when they journey from town to town or world to world, they know what they're going to encounter when they get there. They're kind of looking for what they're going to find. Alex and Sam aren't doing that. This is kind of thrown at them. And again, when kids don't get into the college of their first choice, when 21 and 22-year-olds don't have a job offer by near the end of their senior year in college. This is the kind of thing, this is the kind of metaphor that drives that drives the story. Finding out you're nothing like who you thought you were, and the reason I chuckled when Heather said that, it's so true, because so many kids are, and this is probably younger teens, are struggling with identity, are struggling with figuring out who they are and who they want to be. And being surprised by the result. Kids who are dealing with divorce, kids who are dealing with foreclosure, kids who are dealing with crises that on a day-to-day basis, it's very difficult for the rest of people to relate to. I think one of the reasons why kids are so happy when they're young is they don't have to worry about any of this stuff. 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds never worry about where their next meal is coming from. They're not worried about the bills that are coming in the mail. And I think Alex and Sam, what they have in common is up until the point where this book begins, their biggest concern to jump off what Heather said is where are they going to go to college and what are they going to have for their next dinner? It's the simple, mundane stuff that all gets thrown to the wayside, all gets tossed away when they find themselves embroiled in what is basically a battle to save human existence, a battle to save civilization.
This is scary because he goes to a football accident that I had to read three times to see if it wasn't slightly on purpose. And then they have a CAT scan, and everything goes down there because he's got headaches and he doesn't know why. And rather than leaving him, Samantha decides that she's going to go on this roller coaster horrible journey with him. So why does he goes to the hospital, they alerts the doctor something's wrong, and how come he decides, Alex, this is not the place for me, calls Samantha and says, get me out of here. Why? Why does she even risk her life for him? Not that I blame her, because he's a really cool character.
Well, I think in our case, we were looking at, I'm thinking, and this I remember so clearly this happening in high school. There are the kids that are just kind of there. They're right on the top. They are the the ones that are so admired. And I think what's fun sometimes in real life is it's, you know, you often find out. I think that it's actually a friend of mine, but the nerdiest kid in my high school class became our state's attorney. You know, I mean, it's often the, I mean, well, we're learning this big time now with the Big Bang Theory. You know, it's often that kid who was kind of overlooked and in the books all the time who winds up, you know, going out and having a stellar life. But I think that, I think football, we have always kind of had our football heroes, be it high school, college, or, you know, the Super Bowl coming up. But so Alex has been this kind of one who's like, you know, a shimmering star that you, that she can like almost reach out and touch because they're friends. She is his tutor. But while she's kind of had this little bit of a crush on him, she's always believed, you know, he probably wouldn't really glance her way. You know, he's dating the popular girl, the beautiful cheerleader. So it's just something in her mind. It's not an obsession because her obsession is work. But she's also the one who is at Alex's house when things begin to happen to his parents. And so her tie, her bind with him becomes incredibly close. And, you know, while you don't wake up and decide I'm going to go be a hero, and while neither one of them were the type who, you know, they were not Sister Teresa, they weren't running around doing everything. They were always nice people, but they were high school kids. You know, they were just leading their lives and moving along. And this suddenly happens to them.
They rocked their whole world. As a matter of fact, I was lucky. My mother told me when I was three what I was going to be doing with my life, and thank God I listened. So I didn't have to. really,
talking to Heather and I.
You're going to be an educator. You're going to review books, and that's what you're going to do. But little did I know that there was a whole lot more in between. And I was one of the nerdiest kids in school, but I was smart. You grow out of it after a while. But serious, sort of, I don't know. But she risked her life for him. So Samantha works with Dr. Donati, and she works, like you said, for NASA, and she really wants to do this. But all of a sudden, Alex finds out, she goes to his house, and she finds out that his parents, how hard is it for him to leave his mother and father there and not do something? Why does his mother tell him to go? That was
she knows he's in danger. Yeah, she knows that she's there. I mean, I think it's one of those things too that the bond of love and caring and nurturing is as strong as any blood tie. She loves Alex. She loves her son, and she's willing to do anything for him. She wants him out. She wants him gone before he can be found, and before she knows they want to kill him, and she's going to do, you know, with her dying breath, try to keep him from being killed.
And I think I would add to that that the moment that happens in this book that changes Alex's life forever, the moment that sets him on the road, and it's, and the whole book takes place in 48 hours, so it's not like it's, it's a long journey. The whole thing, Alex's mother knew all along that this day was coming, and that and she spent 18 years protecting Alex. And what we did was, and again, we're talking about metaphor here. We're talking about a story about, you know, two young people who ultimately are the only hope civilization has of survival. But what we did was when we started the series, and you add, this is jumping back to where we started with what Tor was looking to do in their partnership with NASA. And that is the fact that you have many times a year, thousands of times, tens of thousands of times even a year, in this country, Caucasian couples adopt Chinese babies. In this book, we reverse that paradigm. We reverse that paradigm, and it's a Chinese couple that has adopted Alex, or taken Alex in, as the case may be. And when we were talking about this, when we conceived this idea 5 or 6 years ago, obviously, we never envisioned the xenophobia that's been bred by our current president-elect, where all of a sudden anyone who's, quote, different than you and I is singled out. So I kind of think that as much resonance emotionally as the Rising would have had anyway, it has even more emotional resonance now, because the prejudice and bigotry that Alex encounters, one of my favorite scenes in the book, give you an example, is at a carnival when he's very young. And this becomes a plot point, by the way, structurally, as to where this carnival happened years before. Anyway, when he was very young, police thought that he was being kidnapped by his parents because he was Caucasian, blonde hair, blue-eyed, and they were Chinese. So when they saw them together, they thought the Chins were stealing Alex from somebody else. And he attacked the cops who tried to arrest his father. And I think that scene is very, very powerful. I think that scene defines Alex as the football player that he becomes, the person who can crunch people on the field. But I think what Heather says is very, very important, and that is the fact that at his heart, at their heart, these are two very good young people. They exemplify all the greatest qualities of American youth today. American youth today is classified not by the kind of things that some people may want you to believe it is. It's classified by volunteerism and kids who want to do better for others as the same way they want to do for themselves. I think Alex and Sam are like this, and I think what they end up doing is an extension of that. Again, it goes back to the metaphor. Saving the world as you uncover your own identity and the truth of your own being is basically what this story is about. And, it's I think that's where the fun lies. All books like this that move so fast and have so much action, we rely a lot on pacing. We rely on a great story. But at its heart, and this is something Heather always talks about, this is a book about people that you root for. This is a book about people that you genuinely love, these two young people. These are two people that as a reader you are welcoming into your life for however long it takes you to read 398 pages. So we want those people to be inviting. I haven't said this yet, but here's how I would put it. When adults read this book, people my age, I would like them to look at these kids, Alex and Sam, and say, I wish that was my daughter. I would love to have him for my son. If a reader says that, that is probably about the biggest compliment we can be given as authors.
But I think we want to.
Wait, you read my review. You might like.
No, I did. Well, yeah.
I'm going to post it later.
I think that we've taken. I mean, I know on my behalf, I have too. I've taken a lot of things that have occurred in life. And put them in because I do think they're so indicative of what we're talking about too, because I definitely see a lot of this as metaphors, but my son is married to a young lady who came over from the Ukraine when she was 12, and I absolutely adore my daughter-in-law. She's the cutest, sweetest thing in the world, but when they were married, a lot of her friends were here, and most of them, several had moved to Switzerland, several had moved to South America, and all of them spoke 5 to 10 languages. And so I was in the car with her brother's girlfriend, who was Chinese. And so we're in the car. I said, oh, my God, how many languages do you speak? And she started laughing, and she said, I speak one. I was adopted as an infant by my parents, who are a great Jewish couple who's been in New York for 150 years. And she was so cute to me laughing, but it was just one of those instances when you realize we are this big mix-up and none of us, you cannot live life by stereotypes. You really can't, because people are completely different and wonderful and mixed up. And I think that's a lot of what we want to do with Alex and Sam too, is, just, we're using aliens, but if you I'm from Miami, so half of, I would say half to 80% of my population is now Hispanic. And I remember when that first started happening, everybody referred to it as like, oh my God, the alien invasion. So it's kind of like, wherever people, or if we're going to refer to them as people, if they're hominids, whatever, we have a tendency to strike out constantly at what we're afraid of. And sometimes it's smart. Sometimes it's a smart thing to do. But a lot of it has to do with which is it? Are we afraid or are we being smart?
You're right. I grew up in the South Bronx. So you can imagine, I grew up in a tough neighborhood. And I think that's what made me tough to be able to teach in the New York City tough school. Yeah, I was a tough person. And my kids are on Facebook and they'll tell me, you were tough, but without you, we wouldn't have made it to be anything. So I know I did a good job and they still love me. It's scary. This book, I think maybe we should send it to somebody tomorrow before he says, I do. If you can get it for me. Because prejudice is a horrible word, and yeah, right? And maybe he would get the point after the fact that he doesn't quite get it. So there are two men that come to the house. This is scary. And they look at Alex and they say, you belong to us. And Alex doesn't know or understand what's so unique about him. And he came to be, I'm going to go into the letters in a minute upon the chins, but how does he feel when these people say, you belong to us? But he's not naive enough to believe them. That was scary. And he meets the Ash Man. That was even scarier.
Yeah, he has, I think the one thing, there's no way in hell he's going to believe it. He's been raised by people who very much so believe in the American dream. He's going to be independent. He's mentally and physically a strong boy, and now is going to be his time to have to prove it. And then the other thing, too, is he's devastated. There's no way he would accept anything from these people who hurt his family.
Well, that is true. And I like the fact that he's not afraid and that he's got guts and he doesn't back down. And I like the fact that she sort of keeps him centered and in place, too, which means they're a good combination, which I'm going to ask at the end. I do hope you're bringing them back for a sequel, because that's just my hint to tell you that we need, need more.
Thank you. We're definitely planning, yes.
No doubt about it, Fran.
Oh, good. And I get it first, please, before anybody else.
Fran, what you're alluding to, and again, this comes down to what the nature of heroism is, and this is really a story that's drawn along classical lines. If you go back to many of the great stories from mythology, from the Iliad and the Odyssey on, they're about people. They're about invasions. They're about coming to someone else's world to try to take it over. This is where and then the heroes, whether it be Hector or Achilles or the classic heroes through our history and mythology, the heroes who stand up willing to sacrifice themselves to save the worlds that they love or the worlds they feel responsible for. At its heart, The Rising is this kind of classic story where an invasion is about to happen. That's what this book is about. Alex is part of a race or part of a resistance movement from another civilization, a kind of parallel Earth, let's call it, something like that, string theory. That's the thing about this book you asked early on about the technology and about the science. The great thing is neither Heather nor I are very scientific in nature. We're not science geeks. We're not scientists. But I think that's an advantage when writing a book like this, because you only get as much information as we need to know ourselves, which means you get only as much as you need to see, only as much as you need to know to understand and be able to follow the book. Because if I want to wave one cautionary flag, readers shouldn't shy away from this book because it's science fiction, because they may be intimidated by science, in the sense that all the science in this book is woven into the story. It's woven into the characters. When you mention the villainous Ash Man, who's like a holographic projection but has some physical mass, the fun of that is saying, okay, a million years from now, what are holograms going to look like? What could an astral projection actually be in the future? Could it be? Could it have some physical form, some degree of physicality, as opposed to just being a projection? So that's the fun. We're not inventing any new technology. What we're taking is existing technology and trying to imagine it going forward and how an advanced civilization would utilize it. And the great thing about that is Alex has a secret. He is on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
He has been brought to Earth because he possesses the one thing that can win the war, that can stop the invasion. But he doesn't know what it is. He has no idea what it is, the Ashman and the androids and all these mm-hmm. people from another civilization, because of this football injury that he suffers, and he gets a CAT scan, and then they find out that he's there. He has mm-hmm. no idea what he is, what it is that they're looking for. So it's not just a quest to save the world. It's a quest to find out what it is he possesses that will allow him to save the world. And in that sense, the book is as much mystery as science fiction.
Well, we're not going to tell anybody what it is, but there's another character that you know me, 398 pages, 2 hours, not even. You know that.
Wow.
I just sat down. Yeah, not only that, I was lucky because somebody sent two more copies and those are gone. They're gone. My brother-in-law has one, and somebody else has another one. And my husband's got this one. He wants this one because he took three other books that I just got. And he said, "Oh my God, I didn't realize you really get the good stuff." I said, "What do you think? I mean, really?" So who is Rafe? And he calls himself the Guardian Angel. And what happens when Alex realizes that there are other people after him? And I got to tell you, these two kids, I should give this to my niece to read so she can, you know, find herself too. But who is Rafe, and why does he consider himself the Guardian Angel? He comes and goes. He doesn't always remain there. How did you create him? I like him. You got to bring him back too.
He's definitely coming back. Yeah.
I got this on. I nailed this one.
He is, have a situation, which is, I think, true of any situation, is that some of the people coming in, you know, as we mentioned before, are very good. They're looking to communicate. They're looking for us all to improve our lives, our existence through communication. And, of course, some are coming to take over. Rafe's job has been to protect, to protect what they're hoping to become the good of the communication and everything else going on. So he's a very special, or dare I say, person. He's very special, and he'll keep showing up.
Yeah, we don't want to say too much.
Well, Rafe is he came 18 years before. He was the one without. This is not a huge spoiler. I think I can give it away. He's the one who brought Alex over from the other side. And for 18 years, he has done nothing but wait for this day that has finally happened. And I think in classic storytelling, you see this character a lot. If you're familiar with the Lord of the Rings series, Rafe is like the ranger mm-hmm. character played by Viggo Mortensen in that original trilogy. He's like Han Solo in the original Star Wars movies. He's that roguish kind of guy who isn't grounded, who's basis for living, who's, you know, the reason why Rafe lives is based on protecting someone else, his entire identity. So it's kind of a selfless existence. Again, we're getting into the nature of heroism. Rafe doesn't exist to serve Rafe. Rafe exists to protect Alex. And for 18 years, he has waited for the day that's finally come. And he's kind of, I'd say, and see if Heather agrees, he's kind of a bridge character. And what I mean by a bridge character is, in all great science fiction, you have to have a character who bridges the gap between what we thought we knew and what's really going on. Rafe is the character who explains things to Alex, who says, "This is who you really are." In that sense, he becomes a mentor. One of the most influential books in the history of literature is The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell. And if you look at the structure of The Rising, if you look at how the book develops right down, right all the way to the end with the action pack, with the climactic battle set beneath Alcatraz Island. That's what you have. You have this classic structure of heroes who are willing to give up anything to fulfill their duty, and they do it for selfless reasons. They're doing it because they love that, because they have been called to a greater purpose. They have a duty, and there's no greater duty than saving the world from annihilation, and that's basically what the characters in this book are trying to do.
Yeah, they are. This is scary. But how did you create the journal from Alex's mother? Because I cried when I read that. That was really good. How did you decide to include that so that he actually knows where he came from and why she did what she did, and about the doctor?
That, and I'll take that one because it was kind of my idea. We had to do what you just said. We had to teach Alex to know about himself.
Yeah.
Since we had already, in science fiction, nobody dies. But, and this is not a spoiler alert because it's on the book jacket. When Alex's parents are killed, when they pay the ultimate price for the sacrifice they've made for him, there is no way they can tell him anything anymore. So we created what is essentially a video, so it wouldn't just be a diary. It's his mother talking to him. She's actually on screen, so it's much more personal. I've done those kind of scenes before a lot where it's just a diary. But that in this particular book felt flat. So what that scene is, it's kind of exposition in the sense that it's filling in information and background that we did not see chronologically. It's a device. You need the information you're getting. Alex needs to learn it, and this was the most creative way we could come up with doing it. Heather, did I say it about right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've an awful lot to me still hinges upon the fact that these, you're dealing with the other things when you think about it. I lost my dad when I was 20. There is nothing as horrible, as being young and losing a parent. I just think for Alex, the hardest thing is first, on the one hand, realizing that he has to live not just for himself, not just because survival is an instinct, but because they did this for him, for him to go through and survive and make it and everything else. And I think that's something that affects him as well with everything else that will come afterwards with Rafe, with the other characters who come, those who want to hurt him, those who want to help him. One of the things is he will survive because they gave everything for him. You think I'm? Did that make sense, John?
That makes perfect sense. I think that's. I think you said it better than I did.
Okay. You both said it very well. Now, who is the professor? He's scary. Let me tell you. Gosh, he got me the creeps. I wasn't sure about him at first, and I said, "Oh my God, they're going to get involved
Neither
with this guy now too." Yeah. So, who is the professor? Why does he seem he's hiding something? Yet he seems to want to help Alex. And why does Alex insist on going to Laboratory Z? Whoa, that was really. Some of these scenes you could visualize. You graphically described them so well that I felt like I was there with them. And I go like, "Oh my God, I don't know if I want to go there."
Laboratory Z is in that the Heather came up. That was something we came up with relatively early in the process. That's where his mother works as a maintenance worker.
Mm-hmm.
She's there at the secret lab when something bizarre happens, and that leads to Alex coming through what is essentially a wormhole before the facility is destroyed. That's how the Chins come to adopt Alex. He's basically given to them, if you want to put it that way. It's almost
It's her decision because she makes the choice. She knows something's going on, and she makes the choice to save that baby.
Well, she's given to him in a very unusual way. I know that I know.
Yeah.
Yes, and to get to your point about the professor, what Alex and Sam, and this is really a great interview because you're covering all the broad strokes of the story without giving anything away. Basically, they end up back on the site of the original Laboratory Z. And that's where the crazy man, who we call the professor, is. Now, I won't give away, but the audience has seen the professor before. They just didn't realize it. Because what's one of the things that we did in the evolution of the writing of this book is there are signs, and this is where this defines Samantha's brilliance and her scientific knowledge. Something happened 18 years ago when Alex was brought here, when Alex came to this world. And there were signs that it were coming. There were these electromagnetic signals. There was a pattern of destruction across the world. Now what Sam has figured out is there's a pattern of destruction happening again. And what that creates in the book, she tells her boss that, and he realizes he's the guy who figured it out the last time, 18 years ago. He realizes they're coming back. And what that creates is the classic thriller ticking clock. You know something terrible is about to happen. Don't know when, where, or exactly how it's going to happen. That defines, and this is a great thing that we're to be able to talk about that. That moment, that plot device defines the stakes of the story. Because as Alfred Hitchcock told us, or showed us in many of his movies, suspense is created not by destroying the world. Suspense is created by telling the viewer or the reader you're going to destroy the world. And that's what, and then watching it, the entire story unfold. And that's what we find out relatively early in the book. Alex and Sam aren't the only ones who know something terrible is coming. There are other characters like Rafe, like the professor, like Dr. Donati, who is Samantha's boss at NASA, who see the signs. Nobody's got all the pieces. Nobody, including Alex, knows what it is he has either inside him or knows where to find that is the only thing that can save the world. So that's where the fun of the story lies, in putting all the pieces of this puzzle together.
Well, I didn't have to take out my graphic organizer for this one like I do when there are too many plot points. But this one, really, like I said, whoa. I got, there was enough to give you the chills as you're reading it. And every time they got in trouble or they needed money or something, I'd go like, okay, you're going to think of what to do. I could tell you what to do, but you're going to think about it. I know you guys can figure it out. And I was sort of, like you said, rooting for them. So Alex gets headaches and memory loss. And who is Grimes? And Dr. Chu was the guy that helped his parents, but he didn't really want to. So when Alex realizes he has this speech problem and he's got a problem understanding, what does he do? Because this is at the, we won't say why he does have the problem, and he gets these headaches. So how does he deal with that? Because anyone that gets headaches, and I know how that feels, it's horrible.
Well, the headaches are remnants. They're echoes of his past, of the world from which he came. One of the things he does is Alex, when he goes into these trance-like states, he draws things in a sketchbook with no memory of doing it. The sketchbook actually becomes important because it has clues in it. So he has to go back to his house, back to his home, where his parent, the last time he was there, he witnessed the death of his parents. So I think what you're alluding to is the knowledge of he is kind of not coming apart. He is the two people within him, Alex, the Alex that we know as the homecoming king and the blonde-haired, blue-eyed superstar that every guy wants to be and every girl wants to be with. And then we've got the Alex, the true Alex. And something is happening inside him that's actually damaged. Something is wrong from this concussion that he suffered in the football field. So that's where the headaches are coming from. So not only does he have this terrible stuff, this huge mission before him, he's also, his life is in danger.
Well, I think too that that's a lot where
him too.
Where Sam comes in too, because he really has to depend on her. He has to trust her completely because he can't always trust himself.
Well, he's lucky that he has her to trust, because he really can't trust too many other people, that's for sure. But you begin to wonder, can he trust Rafe? Maybe. The professor? Not sure. Everybody else, those two men? Definitely not. We don't know. So there's a word that I looked up. Yes, you have talked about cyborgs, these strange creatures, And you talked about wormholes and time travel, which I always love. I love when people can go across time in a different continuum, and I wish they would take me with them sometimes, too. So how does that come into play, and what is the Bishop Branch, and what link does this have to his father and to Alex's father? That was another scary place, people.
Well, I think one of the things, I mean, I'll go with the first and let John go with the second. One of the things that got us going was we have our editor, Bob Gleason at Tor Forge, is just an amazing, brilliant man who's just madly in love with pretty much so everything that NASA has ever done. And he arranged trips to the Goddard Space Center for a number of his authors. Really an absolutely amazing experience. He arranged for like literally for days. We were in clean rooms. We were able to see things that had been in space, things that were used for space. It was just really quite an incredible thing. And one of the theories that I happen to hear a lot of them, the speeches that tended to be that scientists themselves were most interested in had to do with black holes, wormholes, and that type of thing. And so listening to them, I think that definitely got us going a lot on the concepts of, you know, because quite from this trip to NASA, if you were to ask me, you know, if somebody were to say, you know, where the big, you know, giant green men with bug-like tentacles walking around, I would say no. They do know there's life on other planets. I know there's life on Mars, but it's most probably bacterial. You know, it's going to be something might kill us. God knows, it could be a bacteria that would kill us. But it's not really what we've so imagined so far. And, of course, the thing is, there might be all kinds of life in other galaxies, but it would take you more than a lifetime to get to them unless you did have wormholes, black holes, that type of thing.
Yeah, that's true. And there was something on the news about that they wanted to have some people volunteer to go to Mars on a one-way trip.
Well, actually, they can. I mean, they have the technology to do it now. It's a matter of money.
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
What
they're saying. So, if you can pay to go, you don't get to come back, but you have to bring what you can bring and then survive. And I don't think I'd want to be there. I don't think I'd be quite ready to go yet.
Maybe,
not me either.
They got to perfect it a little more for me.
No,
I'm not going until they have bookstores. When they have bookstores on Mars,
I don't
I'll
even
go.
Like camping, actually. So
I don't either.
No, I need my books, my computer, and my hairdresser. Otherwise, I don't go. Without Tony, I don't go. So,
but you know something?
When you
talk about Mars and you think about one of the most successful movies and books of the last few years has been The Martian, Andy Weir's book, which became the Matt Damon movie, where a man, where an astronaut is stranded on Mars, has to figure out a way to survive and find a way to communicate with the people who left him behind. Again, you have it's pure science fiction in so many respects, so much of that movie, and yet when you watch it, it doesn't feel like it's science fiction. It feels real. I think this is what I meant before about all great science fiction feels this way. I think you can say that about Robert Heinlein's books. I think you could say it about movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the classic sci-fi, The Day the Earth Stood Still, things that are about more. Now, you asked about Bishop Ranch. Which is, by the way, a real place, an office park in Northern California. It is real. We didn't make it up. Bishop Ranch was built on the site of Laboratory Z. So when they find it, it's a matter of – it's a quest. Because for Alex to save the world, first he has to discover the truth about himself. And the quest he is on, the path he is following with the help of Samantha, with her guiding him, is – to get to the root of his own existence, and the root of his own existence, the secret he's holding, is the only thing that can save civilization from destruction.
That is true. So he's got this little thing that his mother gives him, Ming Po.
Ah.
And she said, you can't not have it. You have to keep it. Why does he have to keep it? And then, could we have about 10 minutes more, maybe, or more? What happens when he faces the Ashman and Shadow, and just how deadly are they? The Shadow really scared me. Oh, God. Reminded me of the show The Shadow. Only The Shadow knows for sure. But what is Ming Po? Seriously. My father used to listen to it, and he used to like, you want to listen to it? No, it's okay. I'll pass on that one.
Well, Ming Po is going to feature as we go forward. Ming Po is very special and will be part of the different clues that they get as they move forward to try to find out what it is that they need to know, what they need to do in order to actually fulfill Alex's destiny, really. And it's been, I think part, I was just going to say quickly, to me, is I think John and I are both big fans of the adventure novel, like going back to Robert Louis Stevenson or Kessler or, you know, Sahara, the things where you are out there, or Indiana Jones, you know, the different, you have to keep searching these clues. And you've got some tools, you know, Samantha's incredibly bright and you've got Alex, and so it's not like you're totally blindly groping around. You have tools to work with, but it's a quest. You have to find all these pieces and keep moving forward to accomplish all the things that you need to do for the grand accomplishment of saving the world.
Well, I have a very strange question. I know you said there's going to be
this
a sequel,
but
thank
me.
God there's... Yeah, I know. No, this won't be hard. This would be interesting. Sometimes I write them, and then sometimes they just come to me as I'm listening. I've learned a lot. But I wouldn't attempt to write a sci-fi, no. I'll stick with writing. My writing is the dead body behind the gravestone and what they did wrong. And I'm in the middle of writing Faces 5. Yeah, everybody says that it's a great concept because if somebody did something wrong, I kill them off right away. And then they have to explain how they got there. And nobody feels sorry for these people, but that doesn't really matter. So I'm going to write the next one, and then I'm going to bother people to write, you know, blurbs for the back cover, John, and other people. And if they only if you like it, if you hate it, don't tell me because you know I'll cry. No, it's okay. I take criticism very well. I've been doing that forever. So we've got about 8 minutes. So we'll. Alex has meant we hope he's going to defeat the evil, but, you know, we don't know that from the end of the story. What would happen if Alex were on this interview with Samantha about finding out how he lived a lie as a lie? What would he say when he learns that he's not the person he thought he was? What would Alex say himself if he could speak to the audience right now? And there are a lot of people listening, I could tell you that.
I think he'd be pretty speechless. I think that identity is such a crucial again, for teenagers, for adolescents, identity is everything. And to find out your life is not what you thought it was is about as shattering a thing as can happen. You know, you lose your security blanket. Everything gets taken away. So I think that but the difference between success and failure, that the difference between someone who's going to succeed and someone who's not, is how they respond to the adversity. And Alex doesn't, I wouldn't say he embraces what happens to him, but I'll say he accepts it.
You think, John, that he's going to be conflicted. On the one hand, he feels like, oh my God, I'd be so much better off if they would have just talked to me. And then on the other hand, he sees what they were doing their whole lives and that it was all committed to him. So he's going to be very conflicted right there. I think that if he were brought to it, he would definitely defend his parents. You know, he would say, like, I'm sure they meant to tell me. I'm sure they were getting to it. You know, who expected this? But even underneath, he'd be sitting there a little bit thinking, you know, why didn't you tell me? You know, why didn't you give me more to work with? So I think on the outside he would be very defensive. He would make sure that he cleared them, and then you know on the inside he would still be a little conflicted. And I think Sam would know that beyond a doubt, and she's got her own kind of set of problems too because she knows what they'll do, and she's chosen to run. But she's also got to kind of hope that she doesn't do anything that puts them in line to go after her family.
I think, you know, you just made me think of something else, and that's we're going back to the metaphor and to what all great science fiction does. So many people now in the post-Trump world are terrified of that knock on the door, to tell them they can't be in this country anymore. Some maybe not a knock, maybe a battering ram knocking it down. We're not talking about dozens or hundreds or thousands. We're talking about millions of people who are terrified that knock on the door is going to come. And the chins in the rising have been afraid of that knock on the door ever since they took Alex in. For 18 years, they've been afraid and waiting for that knock on the door, knowing that someday it would come, knowing that there was inevitability to that happening. And yet, so their entire life mission has been to protect Alex. So again, if people read this book now, I think they would say this is the perfect thriller, the perfect adventure story for the world in which we live. But we didn't know that when we conceived it or wrote it, two, 3 years ago. We had no way of predicting the future. But all great science fiction, I mean, can you believe, let's look at H.G. Wells. He predicted basically every major event of the 20th century in the time machine. How did he know? All great science fiction doesn't just reflect metaphorically on our own times. It also looks ahead to what is coming. It holds up a mirror to the future, not just to what is before us now, but what's going to be before us. And I think that's what we were doing almost subconsciously, in the same way that all great science fiction writers, from Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, to Robert Louis Stevenson, who really wasn't sci-fi, but he was classic adventure, to someone like H.G. Wells and Robert Heinlein and Harlan Ellison, Isaac Asimov, I mean, Frank Herbert. The list goes on and on.
Well, my favorite book in the whole world is Robert Louis Stevenson, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Oh, yeah, that's truly
good point.
A fabulous book.
Excellent point.
All the different
things. Because go on.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, it's okay.
I was just going to say that I think one thing with Alex is that my mom was born in Ireland, grew up in Ireland, came over here. So you're talking one generation. I am as American as one can, possibly be. So I see that with Alex as well. He knows nothing. He grew up here. We are products of our environment and the nurturing and the caring we get as we grow. So I think for Alex, he is very passionate about who he is as the son of the Chins, if that makes sense.
Where are you going to place him next? Are you going to transplant him somewhere in the next novel? What's next for him and for Samantha? And what's next for my other favorite character, Caitlin Strong?
We're just talking. Caitlin's going to shoot a lot of people and discover some things about herself.
I wish she would teach me how to do it, too.
What's up for them next is The Rising. When we conceived The Rising, Heather and I had a notion that it would be a very fast-paced book that would take place in a short period of time, very short period of time, and be confined to one area. The next book is going to change that paradigm. It's going to rewrite that model. It's going to take place over a slightly longer period of time, a couple weeks anyway, and it's going to take Alex and Sam on a worldwide, global adventure into the history of civilization, as well as the settings, as they start to uncover facts about things that people may have thought they knew but really didn't.
Are you going to have a prologue in this one like you do in the other ones?
We always have a prologue.
I know, because I start looking up everything. I know. I know. There has to be some history in here somewhere. I knew that. I looked up NASA, and I looked up a whole bunch of stuff, and then I looked up wormholes and time travel. So what is next for you, Heather, and how come I never got any of your books to review? That's not fair. I tried.
I don't know.
I even tried Clive Gussler.
I
never got Clive's books either, and there's a few. And I've even found out yesterday who Cindy Murray is, Kathy Reich's publicist, and I'm hoping that she'll send me something. But, Heather, I never got your books, and I know they're good. I've asked.
Thank you.
Succeeded.
I will try to work on that. Besides this, I actually have seen my very first Charlotte Point Intrigue that came out on the same day. It is called Law and Disorder. And then there's second in – I did not think of that title. It is a good one. I like it. Next up is Perfect Obsession, which is about somebody who kills people in New York City in the Finnegan series. And then three Crew of Hunter books will come out this summer, and I'm not sure what goes on beyond that, but thank you very much. And I will do my best. I will get somebody to send you something.
I have her address.
Well, that would
I'll send
be great.
It to you.
And he knows where to find me because I don't even know. I just open up the mailbox and they're there, which is what happens to me yesterday. The postman came with 4 books, and I said, oh, God, no, because there's like 70 more. I finished 3 yesterday, this morning, because I couldn't, my eyes were bothering me yesterday. And I finished, for those of you that want to know what to read besides getting The Rising, now listen, people, Valentine's Day is coming in. You know, why not put a book in there, you know, with the flowers and the candy? Seriously. And, I mean, to me, yeah, to me that would be the greatest present in the world was a book. And when I went to the library, they used to just say you can only take out 3, except that I don't know why they let me take out as many as I want. Now I don't have to go to the library anymore. I just get as many as I want.
Aww.
Which is really great because I never know what's coming in the mailbox anymore. But yeah, the postman came and gave me 4, and then I had 2 bags of books that I gave him, and he just looked at me and go, "These are for you to read, you know, in case you have nothing to do after you deliver the mail." He was thrilled. So I'm excited. I have not. Yeah, I had tried to get yours. I tried to get Clive Guffler's. I don't know who to send to for that one. And The Hardest Person in the World, and I did review Never Never by James Patterson. That was different, is that he changes publicists every day. Makes it hard. So where can everybody learn about both of you? And this is great. I can't wait to do another one. And Heather, if you send me something, then I could email you or John to tell you that, you know, we could do an interview on based on your book. And when is Caitlin Strong coming out so I know when to expect it so I can, you know, pencil you in for an interview?
Absolutely. December, where she's going to be a Christmas book next year. So Caitlin got moved to December, and it's called Strong to the Bone.
That's
like
such a great title,
John.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know what? It's funny because I think any title with bone in it looks cool, and I think it sells well. There's something about the word bone. You know, mm-hmm. It's kind of like blood, which is why we called our next book in the series Blood Moon, by the way. So it's fun. You're going to see Caitlin back in December, and you're going to see Blood Moon next January.
Am I going to see Greg McCracken ever again?
You're putting a lot of pressure on me here. How many books do you want me to write?
You can write 1 a month. I know that. I got faith in you.
Oh my God, it's a high bar, friend. You're putting a lot of pressure on me.
Yeah, well, all I can tell you that is MJ9's coming out this month. Yay, finally!
Oh,
that's my
God.
Magazine. But readers, writers, authors, anybody that wants an article on anything, I'm still waiting for somebody to write on politics. I think that would be a rip and a half. I got criticized for writing one on obesity. Somebody said that my research was wrong, but I know it's not. So I'm just going to leave it, and I don't really care. Obesity is a serious problem, and I'm not obese anymore, but I was when I was young. I weighed over 200 pounds at one point, which is why I do book reviews, because my sister told me I was getting fat. She was a riot. Yeah, she used to say to me, "Fran, you're becoming a couch potato." My mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, so I had to retire from teaching, which is my passion. I love working with kids and learning disabilities. So I guess I ate myself into oblivion when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. My sister said, "You know, you're getting took like a couch potato. Why don't you review books?" I go, "What are you talking about? What do you do? How do you do that?" So I reviewed The Cookbook, and John knows I don't know one end of a knob of a stove from another. And I did review a cookbook, and the author hasn't stopped laughing since. And after that, I just, keep going. It's great. I think the bravest thing I ever did was email Tess Gerrington and ask her if she would come on my radio show. When she did, I said, oh, my God, yeah. I'm getting her new book.
She's a sweetheart. Tess was with the Goddard Space Center. Yeah.
Yeah, she is really nice. But everybody that I've interviewed is nice. This is great. And I think I almost bumped into you at the Thriller Fest last year, but you had so many people. I'm the little blonde with the different color streaks, because Mel Corcoran noticed right away that I had red, green, blue, and yellow streaks, and I restyled my hair to spike it this time. It looks better.
I'm thinking both my daughters have blue, purple, red, and they've got every color of the rainbow in their hair right now.
I did it on Tuesday again. Yeah, and it looks, from what I gathered, as I walk in the street and people stop me, they think it looks really cool. So, and it also makes me look 30 or 40 years or 90 years younger. So it doesn't really matter what they think. I think I look.
I may go for one giant purple streak, or maybe an aqua blue. I don't know. I haven't decided yet.
It's great because
it's only
I was
there.
Doing,
it can be changed.
You can do it, and you can just, like, they paint it in, and then it washes out after 10 weeks or whatever. Then
yeah,
you get
there
to
you
do
go.
It again. Or you can get a fake extension and put it in and see if you like it, and then if you hate it, you can rip it out. So where can everybody find out about you? And I'm very proud to say we went over the hour, so that's good.
I'm the original HeatherGraham.com because of the actress who is born Heather Joan Graham, as I was born Heather Elizabeth Graham. So sadly, I have her by a few years, so I get to be the original HeatherGraham.com.
This
and
is
me,
true.
You can
and
get you. I'm at johnlandbooks.com, and follow me on Twitter at John D. Land, J-O-N, no H, J-O-N-D, L-A-N-D, just straight through. And I tweet a lot about books, and that's mm-hmm. my primary social media platform. I'm on Facebook. I've got the website. I'm not as good about updating it as I should be, so that's why I say follow me on Twitter. Google the book. There's so much on this book already out there. To determine whether it's the right story for you. But I think it's a kind of universal story. I don't think you need to be a fan of science to like this book. I think you could read it. I think it stands all by itself, and that's because mm-hmm. the heroes are so appealing and the story is so big. I think it's something that everyone is just going to embrace and everyone is going to love.
Well, if you give me about 5 minutes, everybody, I'm going to post my review and see what you think about it. And I have to say that I'm on Just Reviews. That's my review site. And within 5 minutes of posting something, I get 20 people that actually read it or follow it or like it or criticize it. And I don't really care what, you know.
They won't criticize this one.
No, they wouldn't dare criticize the queen of reviews over here, no. But I want to thank you both. This has been great. I'm enjoying myself, and which is great because I have to go for PT afterwards, which is no fun. But we're getting there. Yeah, they told me that I hurt my hand and from overuse of typing too much.
Oh, boy.
And,
really?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I don't care. And the doctor said it's never going to get better, but he's wrong because it is getting better. Thanks to my physical therapist who looks like a rock star. He's really cute. He's about 9 feet tall. He's about 6'10". And he looks like Constantine Marullo from American Idol. And Zach is great. So obviously if I can move my hand and use the mouse on my computer, it must be doing better. So I don't really care what the doctor says. You know, they don't know everything. So thank you so very much. And, John, I will pencil you in. In December, whenever you want.
Sounds good.
You just let me know when, what day you have available. And let's see, I'll pencil you in on the 6th just for temporary, just to have it there, because otherwise my shows are filling up. I'm booked until the end of June. I don't know how. And I'm really excited that John's going to be with me on February 16th to talk about Mood and Tone with Andrew Gross and David Morrell. That should be interesting, right? And
oh, boy.
We're sorry that you missed the last one. The panel show on Monday was fantastic. Alan Jacobson, Alan Topel, Linda McDaniels, Christina Hoag, and David McAuliffe. I didn't have to do anything. They just took it away. It was fantastic. So thank you so very much. Heather, I can't wait to read one of your books because murder is my thing.
Oh, super.
And I'm getting,
thank you so much.
Yeah, and I hope I get to see you at the Thriller Fest next year, right, John?
I will be there. Yeah, I will be there.
And if John lets me know that I have to be there, I'm going to definitely be there. And Jeff is looking forward to coming too, my husband.
You'll both be there
panel.
Again, no worries.
Yeah,
I will
absolutely.
Be there.
Yep.
Thank you so much. Everybody have a great day. And guess what? The sun is shining. It didn't rain. And I will talk to you. Thank you, and bye.
All right. Thank
you.
Thank you, friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hello?